Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. I'm Kate Koff, editor of the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor is the nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to delivering high-quality, nonpartisan investigative and explanatory journalism to inform Mainers about issues across our state and to empower them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. Each month, a panel of reporters and editors will talk about the stories we're working on, many of which you've likely read in your local newspaper or at themainemonitor.org. This month, I'm joined by several Monitor reporters to talk about their recent coverage of the U.S. immigration and customs enforcement surge in Maine. Sean Scott, who covers religion for the Monitor, Christian Moravec, who covers education, public health reporter Rose Lundy, and government accountability reporter Josh Keefe. Welcome to all of you. So just a little context before we begin our discussion. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, more commonly known as ICE, announced on January 21st that it had launched what it called, quote, Operation Catch of the Day. The agency said it was targeting the worst of the worst criminal aliens, their language, and told Fox News that it had 1,400 targets around the state. Last Thursday, Senator Susan Collins announced that the enhanced immigration enforcement operation had ended, though Border Patrol and ICE agents would continue their normal work. That same day, ICE announced that it had detained 206 people during its operation here. As we'll discuss, this included people our reporting found do not have criminal records and have legal status. So we are going to start by talking about some of those cases and how reporters have gotten these stories. Rose, let's begin with you. You were the lead reporter on the first ICE story the Monitor published when this surge began. The story was about a mother of four who was detained after dropping one of her children off at Portland High School. So I'd like you to just start at the beginning for us. What were you doing when you first heard about this case, and what did you find when you arrived on the scene?
Yeah, so this started first thing in the morning. We, as a newsroom, kind of had an all hands on deck approach to this surge of activity. And so I had been assigned to be on call in the Portland area. And as we noticed throughout the surge, a lot of activity happened. A lot of reports came in the morning, kind of during the commuting time and the, you know, school drop-off time. So I remember it was around 8 o'clock or 8:30 we heard about this. My hair was still wet from my shower, which was poor planning on my part, because my hair takes forever to dry, and it was a very frigid day. So when I went out to the scene, my hair was very frosty, and that's kind of the first thing I remember from that incident. But we saw a video of a woman getting detained in the Deering Oaks Park area. And so I responded to the corner where we believed it had happened. It was empty by the time I got there, as we learned throughout responding to many other tips. These were really quick events, you know, happening within minutes, and then people were gone. So I didn't initially expect to find anybody, although there was a neighbor out on the corner. So I talked to him a bit about what he had heard. He hadn't seen the incident, but he had heard from other neighbors. And then there was a nonprofit that shared a parking lot with the apartment building where the woman had been detained. So I knocked on the nonprofit's door. They let me in and I talked to their employees, although none of them had even been at work yet by the time but when ICE had arrived. So none of them saw it themselves. But one of the employees told me that she had talked to a woman who seemed to know what had happened. And as I was talking to this employee, she pointed out the window and said, there she is. That's the woman who saw it. So we ran out together. The woman was getting into her car. And so we came up to her car. She rolled down her window. She was in the back seat. And I just said, hey, I heard that there's been some, you know, ICE activity around here. Do you know anything? And she said, yeah, that was my mom who was detained. And she agreed to talk to me. So she told me what she saw.
Wow. Well, just briefly before we move on, you were talking about all the tips that were coming in, and you said you saw a video. Where did you see the video? Did somebody send it to you? Were you scanning social media? How did you find it?
Yeah, I mean, the whole newsroom was kind of fielding all these tips coming through. I mean, they were coming through in social media. They were coming through, sent directly to us. There were some different websites that seemed to be tracking things. There's a website called Ice Out that had people were sending in reports and tips and videos. And so I think we saw a couple of videos come in a diff couple of different ways that showed the agents detaining the woman. And so we were able to figure out the location and the parking lot through those videos, and then obviously go and independently corroborate and confirm on our own.
Wow. And so you come across this woman's daughter, and she's in this car. What did she describe, and what was it, what was she like when you talked to her? Was she nervous? Like, what? Tell us what that was like.
No, she was strikingly calm, I thought. Very matter of fact, and open to talking. I mean, frankly, I talked to some other neighbors who had seen it, and they were not open to talking on the record and using their name. But the daughter was, and was very candid. She answered all my questions, and she said that she had been home when she got a phone call from her mom. Her mom had dropped off the youngest daughter off at Portland High School for school, and as she was driving back, she noticed somebody was following her home, and so she called her 20-year-old daughter. And the daughter watched from the apartment window as her mom pulled into the parking lot, and a car pulled in behind her, and agents got out and asked her to get out of the car. They ended the phone call with the daughter, and then got her in their car and drove away. The daughter said that her mom is from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. She has no criminal record. We looked that up ourselves at the monitor and did not find a criminal record for her either. And she has four children. She's been in the United States for 10 years, and she has a pending asylum application.
Wow. And just tell us a little bit more about what the daughter said when she what she actually witnessed. Was there any interaction between the agents and her mother in terms of asking her mother to show a passport, or like what was the discussion like that the daughter could see between the agents and her mom?
The daughter said that they did not ask her for any kind of identification. She said that she tried to give them her wallet, and they took her wallet and the phone, and they put it on top of the car. And you can see that in the videos as well. At that time, then the phone call was ended, so the daughter didn't know anything more that they said at that point. But they, did not ask for any identification in that initial interaction.
And since listeners can't see the video itself, what were the agents, what were they wearing?
Yeah, they had tactical gear on. They had vests that said police on the back. Some of them had coverings over their faces, but otherwise, not a lot of other identifying features besides just police on the vests.
And so there's a lot of elements here, and you're obviously, you've got this video and you're talking to the daughter, but you haven't actually been able to speak to this woman yet. How did you go about trying to verify what you heard?
Yeah, I mean, that's why it was important to get talk to somebody who had witnessed it. We didn't want to just go based on the videos that were submitted, although we did have multiple videos of the interaction submitted. So we started with that. You know, obviously getting the daughter to talk to us on the record about it was so important because she witnessed it herself. I talked to another neighbor who witnessed it and corroborated a lot of what was in the video. And then the Portland High School later confirmed that that the woman had been detained and that she had actually been an employee of the high school as well. So through all of that, we felt, you know, like we had confirmed the information in the initial videos.
And ICE has a database of detainees, correct? Did this woman show up in the database? Was her name in there?
Yes, it has a lag time. So she wasn't in there, you know, we were trying to get the story out right when it happened. And she's, you know, I think it's a 48-hour lag time, but she ultimately did end up there and was in Massachusetts.
Josh, I'd like to turn to you now. You did some reporting for that story with Rose, but you were also at a public meeting in Lewiston on the first night of the surge. Talk to us a little bit about what happened at that meeting.
So it was kind of interesting because so obviously didn't have anything to do with the surge, what was going on, but it lined up in some interesting ways. Basically, there was a member of the city council there had resigned. And they had to fill his the rest of the city council had to fill his seat. And the guy who the city council member had resigned because basically he had done some gun charges. There was also this whole controversy about whether he actually lived in the ward that he was representing. But basically he and he was part of the Somali community. He was sworn in and then pretty much immediately resigned. So they had to fill his seat, the rest of the city council. And there was supposed to everyone there wanted a special election. But because of some sort of bizarre paperwork error when they were rewriting the charter, there wasn't an ability to do a special election. They had the city council had to pick somebody. So they actually took applications. And there were five applications, and but there were really two kind of front runners who had constituency there at the meeting who spoke. So everyone, you know, there was hours, a couple hours of people getting up and speaking who they wanted the city council to pick. Everyone, I believe every single person, like dozens of people, either spoke on behalf of Kiernan Medjerus Collins, who is a immigration lawyer and kind of a he's involved in Democratic politics, and that was the Somali community kind of really rallied around him. And then there was Rin Soleclair, who was the person who lost to the previous city council, the guy who resigned, and she had been the incumbent. So there's this, and there's sort of the overlay of politics here is, you know, even though it's the city council is a nonpartisan position, like. Majerus Collins is clearly a Democrat. He's running for the legislature, and Soleclair is pretty clearly a Republican. You know, there was a gubernatorial candidate, David Jones, the Republican gubernatorial candidate, was like there to support her. So anyway, what ends up happening is there's like this serious discussion. This discussion becomes you know, it's sort of inevitable that it becomes about ICE being there, right? And you have lots of members of the Somali community, lots of members of you know you know allies, sort of white allies of that community, getting up and saying, you know, we're under attack. We want Kiernan Medjerus Collins, who's you know doing the kind of legal work to you know he talks about he gets up and he talks about how he's been that day fielding calls, trying to find out where people are. You know, people have been taken by ICE. He's trying to help. And then you have, and they are very opposed. His sort of backers are very opposed to Rinsault LeClaire, who, has posted stuff on social media that they find really objectionable. I looked through it. It's sort of pretty standard right wing, stuff. But she had posted a video of an ICE officer kicking a protester or shoving him to the ground. It was like, let's go, supportive. So it became this very like kind of anti-ICE versus somewhat pro-ICE meeting. And I should say, like, she was never in her comments was never like pro-ICE. She, talked about how she wanted to bring everybody together, and like her supporters weren't like, we support what ICE is doing. They just didn't talk about it at all. And so there's this sort of question of democratic legitimacy, right? Which is they the people who didn't want the sort of Democrat coded people who wanted Joris Collins are like, you can't appoint Rinsault because the voters just rejected her. They chose this other guy. And her supporters are like, you can't choose anyone but her. She just came in second to a guy who shouldn't have been on the ballot in the first place. So both sides had this somewhat reasonable argument that like the voters had chosen either, had either chosen their person or sort of, voted against her. So anyway, I mean, well, what was really sort of striking, one, it was just an overflow. There were people in the hallway, they set up a TV, there were so many people there. But there was also a lot of talk about from, the Somali community, there were a lot of people there who were talked about how they don't remember Somalia. They have no connection to, that country. And they're like, I was taken here as a child. I've been raised here. I'm as American as anybody. I shouldn't have to carry my passport around. I shouldn't have to worry about whether to send my kids to school today. There's talks about people basically hiding. A lot of these people have never known anywhere else and certainly don't consider themselves anything other than Americans. And a lot of them are American citizens. I mean, people from Somalia have been, that community has been growing for 25 years. So, I think the majority are American citizens now. So it was all sort of all this tension about ICE and about them arriving sort of played out at this kind of this city council meeting, which sort of it just happened to be the same day as it started.
Yeah, a meeting that probably, probably would not have gotten that kind of attention had NICE not been in town. Yeah. What,
But
right.
to be
Who,
to,
yeah.
what happened though was the city council ended up choosing neither of the two. Somebody who nobody had actually sort of spoken up for. It was pretty clear they sort of just decided we're gonna have to make a lot of people mad either way, so we'll just make everybody mad.
It's a fascinating story, in part because of the sort of odd procedural thing that you described at the beginning, where there wasn't an election, even though that seemed like the natural way of things and like the way it should have gone and what most people wanted. It's a fascinating story for that as well.
I mean, one of the city councilors was basically like, I'm sorry you're gonna have to witness this because we're gonna have to build this plane as like they had to vote on how to do the process as they're going through it. Like they were creating the process because there was no precedent or sort of standard. So yeah, it
According,
was heated, to say the least. It got very heated in there. But it was, yeah.
municipal government reporting, you never know what you're going to get. Sean, I want to turn to you a little bit. You spoke to the group behind the ICE hotline that was set up, the Maine Immigrants' Rights Coalition. Can you tell us just a little bit about their work and that hotline and what their data showed throughout the surge?
So the Maine Immigrants' Rights Coalition is a nonprofit advocacy group in the state. Predictably, they work on immigrants' rights and kind of connecting them with supports throughout the states. They have dozens of different kind of partner agencies that they work with. One of the initiatives that they have been working on, they started, it officially launched last fall, but they had been kind of thinking about it since the Trump administration came back into power last January, is their ICE hotline. So the way that it works is they have trained operators and trained verifiers, and people, if they see activity that they suspect to be ICE, or they have a loved one who's been detained, or they're experiencing something themselves, they can call this hotline to either get connected with supports or to report activity. When they're reporting activity, if the hotline operator believes that it's significant enough action or there's some benefit, they might send out a verifier to document the ICE presence without interfering. And so they had built out this framework already before the immigration surge started in January. And then once it did actually start, I spoke to them about some of the kind of statistics behind it, and it was an incredible jump in activity. Just in the week kind of leading up to the operation before it actually began in earnest, but when everyone was, when it was like at the front of everyone's minds, they had a, I think, a 3,800% increase in calls. And then the week of the operation itself, at one point, they had more than 1,000 calls in a single day. And at that point, they only had 50 trained operators who could answer the phone. And these are people who have to be multilingual in some way in order to be able to do it. So they had more than 50 people, and they had about 500 people who were in the training process or had indicated a desire to volunteer. And that was on January 21st. I've followed up with them since then on January 29th. And at that point, they had more than 2,000 volunteers. So that's just over the week that this action was taking place. And they, so they saw the increase, but then since the operation has died down, they did, they're still recording active calls, almost 200 a day, most days last week, but much less than the kind of 1,000 calls that they were getting at the height of it.
What are people calling about? What are the nature of these calls? Are they looking for attorneys, or are they just reporting activity by ICE? What were they calling about?
Yeah, most of the calls were to report sightings of ICE. They categorize them at different levels. They have some sightings that they say are firsthand, some where they're saying they believe that ICE is staked out somewhere, and then some that are secondhand sightings. So that's kind of the bulk of the calls. Other of the calls were for referrals for services, whether that's helping connect people who have been detained with legal resources or helping the families of people who have been detained. There are kind of a few different categories that that falls in. And then one of the last categories that they have that I found interesting was bad faith calls. They, the Maine Immigrants' Rights Coalition doesn't, they don't log every call or they don't categorize every call, just the like most important ones. But from that first week, they logged 66 calls that they labeled as bad faith, which I found interesting.
Does that mean essential, like intentional misdirection, or what is bad? What's a bad faith call?
I believe intentional misdirection or giving false information.
Interesting. Well, we need to take a quick break here. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. This month, we are talking with a panel of reporters about their coverage of U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement in Maine in recent weeks. Rose, we're going to turn back to you to talk about another case we are following. You and Josh both reported on this one, which involved a man who was driving and was cut off by ICE agents, who then smashed his window and detained him. Josh, actually, maybe why don't you start? Tell us about how you two heard about this incident and what you did when you arrived on scene.
Well, we heard about it. I think it was the ICE Out website that people submit tips to. And then I think I was out driving around. I don't know if Rose was, but it was pretty near her apartment. But yeah, we kind of saw it, and then I think we both just sort of headed there. And basically, what we found was that there had been ICE had there had been a video somebody had posted, which Rose can talk more about. I think she. But anyway, we get there, and it turns out that they had smashed this guy's window, taken him out of his car, and just left the car there running. Kind of in the road, and then a good Samaritan, because it was right across from a parking garage, sort of a good Samaritan, I guess, just jumped in and moved it up into the parking garage. And the attendant, we talked to the attendant, and the attendant was like, "Yeah, I guess I just let him move it in. Better than kind of staying in the road." So yeah, by the time we got there, I guess Rose got there a little bit before me, but yeah, his coworkers had, I guess, kind of figured out what was going on, and we're going down there. And so Rose was able to talk to them and find out who he was.
So was the car like really truly in the road just running, or was it pulled over to the side at all, or just
I
in
think
the
it was
middle of two?
on, I think it was, if I recall, it was sort of, he had pulled over, I believe. So it was sort of on the side of the road, but yeah, I mean, they had smashed the window and left it.
So I talked to one of the witnesses who had actually filmed the aftermath of it, and he was on the street when it happened. So he saw the person who was detained was coming down the street, and an unmarked car cut him off so that he had to stop. And agents got out, and the witness said they went up to the window, and within a minute, they were already using a crowbar on the car window, and then almost immediately smashed it. And they took the man out of the car. The car was still running, and they drove off with him, and left the car running with an open window, and all of his belongings were in the passenger seat of the car, and his cell phone was on the street behind it, and witnesses filmed that happening. And as Josh mentioned, we talked to the parking lot attendant who was there. He didn't see it as it happened because it happened so quickly, but he was there in the moment. And one of the witnesses who had been filming it asked if they could move the car off out of the street because it was still running. And just, it's a two lane, one on each side lane street, so it was in the road. And so they moved the car into the parking lot. And parked it there. And so, by the time I got there, it was the car had been moved, but there was still glass in the road from where the window had been smashed. And I kind of thought that, it's by two parking lots. I didn't really expect there to be anybody around. It wasn't like there were businesses or homes or somebody who would maybe be able to talk to us. But when I was standing on the sidewalk trying to look at the video again to make sure I was in the right spot, I saw a woman really brusquely, or like briskly, walk across the street towards the parking lot attendant, and I saw him come out. And so I followed her because I thought I wanted to talk to the attendant, and I thought the woman honestly was another journalist. So I thought we might have to, both try to talk to the attendant together. But it became clear immediately that she was colleagues with the man who had been detained. And both of them were willing to talk to us about what they knew and shared information about the incident and the person who was detained. But they were both, pretty distraught and distracted initially. So they were trying to figure out what to do with the car, and could they take the car, and could they, what to do with his belongings. And then, that's when I think Josh was out and about responding to a lot of different tips in the area. And so then he joined us then, and then like from there we kind of tried to talk to as many people as we could and confirm as much information about the incident as we could get. And we learned from his colleagues that the person who was detained was employed by a engineering consulting company in Portland. He had earned his master's degree from the University of Maine. in civil engineering, and he'd been working for the company for at least almost 3 years, and had no criminal record, and was here on a work visa.
Do you know where he is now?
I believe he's been released and is back in Maine.
Well, I mean, everything you all have described is very, this is a very kind of dramatic scene. I think for those of us who maybe have not been in southern Maine or not been in the Portland area in recent weeks, it's hard to understand what it's actually like to be on the ground there. So I'm wondering if all of you could just speak a little bit to what it has felt like. I mean, we see the images on TV and we read these stories of yours, but I'd like to get a sense of like what it feels like on the ground. I don't know who wants to. Josh, do you want to start us off?
It was weird because I think when we heard that there was this ICE operation, I think we thought it'd be like Minneapolis, or at least I thought it would be like that, where there's sort of a big show of force, where you kind of see them everywhere, where it feels like an occupying army. I mean, Minneapolis had more ICE agents than there were Minneapolis police officers, like by a few, times. This felt much different. It felt much more surgical. Part of that I think is also just due to the population's less dense here, right? Like we're sort of spread out in a way we aren't in a major city like Minneapolis. But as a result, it was almost like felt like you were sort of chasing ghosts. And you were hearing about, people just being yanked off the street, and then a minute later there's nothing there. It was like it sort of never happened. It was like people were getting abducted by aliens or something. But as a result, it was like, oh, there's out of state plate. It like I you could see people kind of, I don't know, as I was driving around, making eye contact with people, and it just felt much more like this sort of heightened awareness. There's a couple times I got to a place, and then there was like, sort of community members who've been on these signal chats that were also kind of trying to find the ICE and who they'd been taken, and try and talk to them. And they were, very, they would share some stuff, but wouldn't tell you their name. And then like they were gone, then another one would come. And I get to one scene where it was like a guy had been taken, working on a house flip, and they had left his van. He had been driving his van away, and they pulled him over. And so the van was just kind of in this guy's yard. And so I knocked on the door of the house where the van was kind of halfway in the yard. And I was like, was somebody doing, were they doing construction here for you? And he's like, no, I think it was that house over there. He's like, I got home from work, and I was wondering why there was an abandoned van in my yard, So it was just these kind of almost like eerie kind of scenes after the fact, more than it was for me anyway, more than was seeing stuff happen. But obviously, I mean, it was happening. You can see that on social media. So yeah, it just kind of always felt like I just missed it, and this weird thing was happening. I couldn't quite kind of grab,
It's an interesting way to, like, the chasing ghosts is an interesting way to describe it, especially since we were all, and I'm sure there were a lot of other journalists and people who were monitoring all of the chatter around this online. And it felt, being far away and just looking at it online, that it just felt really active and really intense. But what you're describing is it's just, that's a very different picture than that.
Yeah, I mean, it almost felt like, it's like, like being a lifeguard or something, where it's, just in the sense that it's just long stretches of kind of boredom, and then a few seconds of total panic and, action, and then long stretch,
Like the
but
hurry up and wait.
but I mean, but it was happening all around, like you could see it. But there were, so I think the strategy is to be quick and get people out of there, and not to kind of create a scene that allows lots of people to show up, because that was what was happening in Minneapolis. The the reactions were so fast that, I was listening to people talk about, somebody would be like, ISIS here. And within, again, because population density is much higher, like within a minute or two, you have 40, 50 people. So it, I think the idea was to be kind of get in and out, grab people and prevent there from being some sort of larger scene. But I mean, that's just my hypothesis. I don't know.
Was that Sean and Christian and Rose's? Was that kind of what you all witnessed as well?
Yeah, I would echo the feeling of like chasing ghosts. It was, we were getting a lot of different reports from different sources. So on the couple of days that I was driving around, I can remember like three or four times in a row getting a tip, driving out to where I had heard that ICE was, and then there's nothing there. And knowing that they were in the area, but just always seeming to be like behind them, or they were going so quickly that it was impossible to actually catch anything while it was happening. I actually had, there was one moment where they were kind of like steps from where I live, and I had gotten the report that they were out there, so I just walked over a couple streets and they were already gone. Just very hard to catch anything happening while it was happening. But then at the same time, I was like, I could see five or ten other cars or people going around doing the same thing as me to kind of see if ICE was there or not. Observers who were trying to document what was happening. It was a really weird experience, honestly, like having so many different people in a Home Depot parking lot looking for two cars at one time.
Yeah, we're gonna talk in a little bit about that, but the great story that you all wrote about the tactics of observers, but the this you did get a sense from the online chatter of the suspicion, I think maybe is what you're describing. Like everyone is suspicious of one another. There were, to your point, Josh, like a lot of reports of, this person has a New Hampshire plate, is this an ICE agent? And nobody really being certain on knowing what to look for, in part because there was no clear identification of these agents.
Right. I mean, this is what happens when you sort of just throw a bunch of, unmarked vehicles. I mean, I guess the masks kind of give them away, but it's also like, I think the point of law enforcement, the reason cops ride around with clearly marked vehicles is to give some sort of sense of, here they are. Here's the, stability or whatever, this is obviously not that at all. I think, I mean, there's a reason, we talk about chasing or whatever, but I think for a lot of people, especially, people of color, whatever, wherever they're from, or if they're even American citizens, like I know people who just kind of camped out in their homes for a week or whatever it was, because there's not a sense of, like we said, we're chasing ghosts. Like it probably felt like ghosts were chasing them, and that's a, there's a reason why people talk about, feeling terrorized. I think that's part of that.
What, Rose, were you gonna add something?
It just was struck by. There were so many reports in my neighborhood. I mean, there were a lot around me. And you could kind of, but never saw them myself. I mean, they were just so quick. But I think what also was striking is that it was kind of on everybody's mind, even if people weren't seeing the incidents themselves, a couple of the scenes that I responded to, neighbors came out and were like, trying to talk to me about they hadn't seen anything themselves, but they saw people kind of congregating and wanted to come and see what happened. And I was walking back from the gym one morning, and in one of the snowbanks there was a message about ICE written into the snowbank, which I just thought was kind of striking. I mean, there's just signs everywhere, and it's just kind of on everybody's mind here, even if we aren't seeing the interactions themselves ourselves like you might see in Minneapolis. it's just on everybody's mind anyway.
Well, we need to take another break here. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Main Monitor Radio Hour on WERU-FM. This month, we are talking with a panel of reporters about their coverage of U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement activity in Maine in recent weeks. So, Christian, I want to talk to you now about another case that we have been following of an Angolan man who went missing in South Portland. So tell us a little bit about this story. How did you first hear about it? And just give us a sense of what's going on here.
Yeah, so a couple weeks ago, or at least I think it was a couple weeks ago, somebody had reached out directly to the monitor who knew this man from Angola. His name is Evaristo Kolonji. And he had asked basically if we were going to cover his detainment. So I reached out to learn a little bit more, and he didn't have a whole lot of information. So he put me in touch with Kolonji's pastor. And it was through this pastor and this pastor's family that I was able to learn that Kolonji was an asylum seeker. He had a pending case that was it had originally a court date set for this year, which was very recently postponed to 2028. And he had been detained during that first week of operations. And he kind of had just disappeared at first. People in his church community, of which he's very, Kolonji is very involved, had noticed that he did not show up for work. He had a job at Chipotle, and it seemed, according to the people I've spoke with, it seemed that they had reported first that he hadn't shown up for work. And so people who knew him and lived with him started asking questions around. And then they eventually reached out to the pastor, who just the night before had told his congregation that they could reach out to him if anything were to happen or if they had any concerns or worries as this operation unfolded. There was a, this pastor spent a couple hours searching for Kolonji, and he eventually found his car on a street on Westbrook Street in South Portland. There was nobody in it. It was just parked, unlocked with the keys on the floor. And so by then he kind of, this pastor kind of suspected that, maybe Kolonji had been detained, but he wasn't really able to confirm that till he got a call from Kolonji that evening from a detention center in Massachusetts, saying that he had been detained and he wasn't sure why. And I was able to kind of look up some information about his case. I was able to confirm that his asylum case is still pending. I could see that by the time I had connected with the pastor, he had actually been moved from Massachusetts to a Rhode Island detention center. So I could see where he was at the time. And I w also was not able to pull any criminal history on Kolonji whatsoever.
Wow, there's a lot in there. So he was in the course of applying for asylum, you said, but he had a court date that was postponed.
Correct. He had an active asylum case.
Active asylum case. So within sort of within the process, and just waiting on the system. So you spent a lot of time with the pastor. Who, as you said, Kolonji is very active in his church. And the pastor is really kind of a central figure here because some of, his congregants don't have family in the United States. Tell us about your visit with him.
Yeah, so he very kindly invited me into his home. I spoke with him and his family, his four daughters and his wife. So I spent a lot of time there just kind of talking about their relationship with Kolonji. They all kind of described him like a family member, even though they're not related. The pastor said that he's like a son, which is why he kind of set out searching for Kolonji. The daughters I spoke with kind of described Kolonji like a brother, just very personable, easy to talk to, somebody who looked out for them. During that conversation, the pastor had made it pretty clear that he thinks of his role as a religious leader in his community goes beyond just preaching. I had mentioned that he had offered to be available to his congregants as this operation unfolded, since they were clearly worried. And I think what's also unique about this pastor's congregation is that Kalonji is actually the fourth person to have been detained in the past 6 months. He had three other congregants who were detained. And so he described his congregation as being very fearful. People were worried about coming in person to services. They were worried about going to work. So that's part of the reason why he started offering to be available by phone. He started doing some online services so people could still have access. But in regards to these four people who have been detained, this pastor also has been organizing a lot of the legal representation for these individuals, helping them get connected with lawyers, trying to coordinate money in some cases. And I thought one thing he said that was really striking is that, his job is to preach the Bible, but he also needs to care for them as well.
Well, I think I remember when you were telling us about this at one of our newsroom meetings, you described a really kind of intense scene in which his phone, like while you were sitting with him, was kind of ringing off the hook from people who, were in need or knew someone who had been detained and wanted some help.
Yeah, when I sat at his home for a couple of hours, and he was just constantly silencing calls coming in from people, texts. He showed me the correspondences between him and the lawyers for the multiple people he was trying to help. And when I was interviewing his family, he actually just started taking those calls. He was clearly very his congregation was very clearly relying on him for a lot.
And where is Kalonji now, as far as we're aware?
Yeah, so I checked the ICE detainee locator system this afternoon. He's still in Rhode Island. So it looks like he's been there for about a week, maybe a little bit more.
And this is that same database that we were talking about earlier, where ICE, Sean, speaking of sort of the faith community, you spoke to some of the faith leaders who staged a pray-in at Senator Susan Collins' office last week. What did they have to say?
The faith leaders, kind of before the pray-in specifically, there's a group of faith leaders in the greater Portland area who have been very active on immigration anyway. They've had a regular vigil outside the Cumberland County Jail praying for ICE detainees, as well as ICE agents. Actually, when I spoke to them, they were kind of clear on they're praying for people impacted in all ways by this. But the pray-in for Susan Collins specifically was focused on, they had two demands, which were to, one, get ICE out of Maine, and then two, for Senator Collins to vote against the DHS funding bill. It was a group of about 30 or so people who went to her office in Portland, and they were there for about an hour. During that hour, the police showed up, and they gave them a warning that if they continued to stay, they were going to be charged with trespassing. So eventually, nine different faith leaders were arrested and charged with criminal trespassing as a result of that event. But I talked to a couple of them after being arrested, and they were kind of, first of all, they were aware that that was something that might happen going into it. And then, second of all, they were talking about, for them, there is a kind of religious imperative in welcoming the stranger, standing up for the vulnerable. And they felt like in this particular moment, as faith leaders, it was important to be vocal in a very public way, which is part of why they staged this pray-in, even if the odds of it having a direct impact were not super high.
So Sean and Christian, I want to talk to you about your most recent story. We've got about 10 minutes left here. So I really want to talk to you about this story that you published on Sunday. And this was a really interesting one about the tactics that ICE has been using when they are interacting with observers, who are these folks we were talking about who are driving around observing ICE activity. So, Christian, maybe you can start us off, or Sean, whoever wants to take this. What kind of tactics have we seen the agency use here?
Yeah, so we talked to several people who had been observing themselves, and we also looked at a lot of different videos for it. One of the tactics, which I think we saw in Minneapolis as well, is that most of the time when the observers started to film the federal agents, at least one of them would appear to start filming back, or at least taking pictures, and that was of the observers' faces. I saw one video where the person took a picture of their license plate. There are also a couple different videos from Maine of agents holding canisters that look like mace. Whether there's one where they're shaking the canister, but there's one where it's just in the agent's hands. The Bangor Daily News had reported about projectiles. They described them as paintball-like projectiles being fired at a couple of cars in a Home Depot parking lot. And then I think the tactic that was the most striking to me that we focused on was agents would drive to observers' houses. We heard, I think, at least three different cases of an observer who was around federal agents, and then the federal agent would start driving away. And the observer would drive behind them, and the agent would lead them directly to their house. And in one case, the agents got out and like verbally talked to the person. In another, they just pointed at the house to let them know where they lived. And the people that we talked to, I think, unanimously described it as kind of a warning or an intimidation tactic, even though they did continue to observe after it happened.
Yeah, that was really striking to me as well. And actually, so Christian, maybe you can tell us about the experience that South Portland resident Bob Peck had with immigration agents and how he's since responded.
Yeah, so Bob Peck, during that first week of the enhanced immigration enforcement operation, was in the process of following agents on the road. He kind of describes following from a safe distance in his own vehicle, just to kind of with the goal of observing what these agents are doing in his community. And one car that he was following had pulled over onto a side road. He also pulled over and two agents got out. So he began filming his interaction with them. They approached Bob's car. Bob had stayed in his car when these agents had gotten out. And so Bob just had a window cracked when they approached and asked him if Bob was following them. And Bob said, yeah. These agents then cite a code saying that he's not allowed to impede law enforcement. And so Bob then responds, I'm observing, I'm following, but I'm not impeding you. And so they kind of go a little bit back and forth, and one agent then says it is impeding, and then he also adds on that if he doesn't stop, that meaning Bob Peck doesn't stop following them, that he will be pulled back out and arrested. And so Bob found this interaction pretty jarring. And just last Friday, he actually filed a notice of claim. It's a legal claim under the Federal Torts Act. And he is asking for $7.5 million in damages because and he's essentially alleging in this claim that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and Immigration and Customs Enforcement violated his civil rights as a U.S. citizen. But that's just the first step of taking any sort of action in terms of a lawsuit. The government agencies will actually have around 6 months to respond to his claim. They could counter the $7.5 million ask. They could deny it. They could just not answer, which would count as a denial. And then, if that happens, he could take further action.
It's going to be really interesting to see how that winds up. I know we're tracking quite a few court cases in relation to this administration. So that will be another we will add to the list. So I think we have time to maybe talk about one or two last cases here. Sean, tell us briefly. You talked to somebody who was also followed, correct? Who were identifying only by his first name, Stuart. Tell us briefly what happened to Stuart.
Yeah, so Stuart is a resident in Scarborough, Maine. He is a Navy veteran. And he, when the increased enforcement was happening, he had started to kind of observe the Scarborough ICE facility daily just to see who was going in and out, and keep track of the federal agents there. So one day while he was there, he said he saw an agent appear to run his license plate. And then later on that day, as that agent left, Stuart drove behind him with a friend in the car, and they had seen online some discussion about the tactic of driving people home. So they were, you can see in the video, they're kind of joking about the possibility that he's going to be driven home. And then as the agent starts making the turns that lead to Stuart's house, he's like, oh, they actually are driving to my house. So they continue to drive behind, and they get into Stewart's neighborhood, and they can see the car at the SUV that they believe to be federal agents at his house. As Stewart himself approaches in his car, the agent flashes his internal lights and then points at Stewart's house, which he interpreted as a warning, letting him know that they were there. But they never spoke to him directly. So Stewart has since then, he filed an informational report with the Scarborough Police Department, as well as a report with the Inspector General for DHS.
Well, this is all, there's a lot to follow up on here, clearly. Thank you all for your reporting. We are at time here, unfortunately. But thank you all so much. And you have been listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. It's a nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We were joined today by reporters Sean Scott, Rose Lundy, Josh Keefe, and Christian Moravec. You can read their work at themainemonitor.org. We are still actively covering this issue, so please reach out if you have tips or thoughts on stories. You can find more information on our website. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. If you have stories you want to share with our reporters, you can find their emails at themainemonitor.org. The Maine Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can also listen on the WERU app. Subscribe to the show as a podcast or download archived shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Kate Koff, and this is Community Radio WERU FM 89.9 Blue Hill. Thanks, everyone.